Hello, and welcome to the Lawfare Podcast. I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the second of the three podcasts I recorded down at the MILOPS conference in Singapore. It is, I know, the height of vanity to record one's own speeches, to broadcast on one's own podcast, hosted on one's own blog. I plead guilty, but I realized the other day that one person who had never been a guest on the Lawfare podcast was yours truly, and as long as I was recording other people's speeches at MILOPS, I might as well record my own too. The speech is entitled Legislating for the Wars We Fight.
Thanks very much. It's great to be here, completely jet-lagged. It's lovely to see so many faces I know and to meet so many people that I didn't know until today. Thanks very much, particularly to everybody who brought me here, particularly to Captain McCarthy and Commander Adams. When Commander Adams asked me to give this talk, I asked him what he wanted me to talk about, and he told me, I fully expected, because it's the answer I always get, something about Guantanamo habeas and detention law, and I was all sort of ready to grumble, okay, I'll give another talk about Guantanamo habeas and detention law, which I speak a lot about and I'm really sick of, as I suspect a bunch of other people in the room. And to my surprise, he responded with something that was actually very close to my heart. He told me he wanted me to talk about legislating for the wars we fight. Now, this is a subject that I was a little taken aback when he mentioned it, because it was sort of a stab right in the heart, a subject I've been thinking about a lot recently, and I had been thinking about before. I actually wrote a sort of 1.5 books on the subject, and I have been wondering in recent days, for reasons I will explain, whether the thesis that I articulated in the first of those books needs at this point to be revisited. And so it's actually a very good opportunity to sort of reflect a little bit on this subject, which is, I think, of general importance, not merely to the United States, where it is of enormous importance, but internationally as well. So let me start with some general observations. And then I'm going to take a step back and look back over 10 years of efforts to legislate in the counterterrorism space in the United States. And then I'm going to try to draw from those a series of lessons about what we can and can't expect legislation to do with respect to wars that we mean to fight, or that we are fighting, or that we suddenly find ourselves fighting. So the first general observation is that in many ways this is not a new problem. When you start thinking about legislating for conflicts, you start running into examples of it from all over the place. I've been recently, for reasons utterly unrelated to this, doing some research on the history of the War of 1812. It's the 200th anniversary of the War of 1812, and one of my colleagues is writing a book on this, editing a book on the subject, and asked me to contribute an essay on James Madison's view of executive power. And so I was doing some research on this subject, and I ran into this amazing law called the Torpedo Act, which some people, and particularly the Navy officers here, may know something about. The Torpedo Act, which Congress passed in the outset of the War of 1812, basically responded to the problem that we didn't have all that much of a Navy at the time. It was a very nascent. And so we basically set up a bounty system where Congress, if you were, as a civilian, able to take out a British ship, Congress would pay you for it. So this would be a really interesting example of sort of legislating for the wars we fight. What happens when you fight the British Army, the British Navy, and you don't actually have a Navy really yourself? You sort of set, Congress kind of responds to that with its own proposals. So in that sense, the problem is not new. But there are elements that are new that are kind of worth fleshing out. So I think there are three, and they're all interrelated. The first is that, as all of you know and are a reflection of, we have increasingly legalized warfare and lawyerized warfare. Now, there's a huge literature which some people in the audience have been active participants in this debate over whether this is a good thing, a bad thing, a neutral thing. I'm not going to go there except to observe that it's a very substantial change. And if you have this legalization over a long period of time, it puts an enormous premium on the question of substantively what the rules are. But it also inherently, I think, puts a premium on the question of who makes those rules and what the mechanisms that you have to make those rules look like. Now, legislation is one of those mechanisms. It's, in fact, the sort of classic, if you think about the fifth grade civics lesson in the United States about three branches of government, right, in which we have an executive that carries things out and a judiciary that interprets the law, legislative branch that makes the law, it's kind of the prototypical means of making the rules. Second factor, which I think, you know, Blanchard really referred to in his remarks, and I want to second, is that the technology is changing extremely quickly. And so that inevitably raises the question of how you're going to have rules that are responsive to changed circumstances based on technology. Again, legislation is one possible answer to that question. And then the final thing is that reason that this puts a premium on the question is that the nature of the enemies that we tend to face is also changing relatively quickly. So in the last 20 years, I think the United States has really moved from a vision of its likely conflicts as involving other states to a vision of its likely conflicts as incorporating very small groups of people, which I think most of us really hadn't kind of imagined before that. And now I think in the cyber arena, you are also talking about circumstances in which you have an adversary and you don't even really know who it is, right? So you have even changes not merely in the nature of the technology, but changes in the nature of the enemy in the context of a overall legalization of the process that puts a very large premium on rules. Now, all of that is, as I say, a real emphasis on this question of A, what the substance of the rules are, and B, who makes them. And that brings you back to the question of legislation, right? Now, the question of legislating for the conflicts that we fight is actually not one that has an obvious answer. There are a lot of sources of law for conflicts. And it's not historically the case or necessarily self-evident that Congress has a sort of major front role to play in this, in the sense that legislation is a very long process. It takes a long time. There's a danger, actually, to getting way out in front of a situation legislatively. Some of you, I'm sure, are more familiar than I am with the story of the Balloon Warfare Convention, which is actually not a legislative effort, but an international treaty. You know, that was an example in the turn of the last century of the countries getting together and sort of envisioning a great threat to civilized warfare, which was balloons, hot air balloons. And so there's an international treaty. I think it's still technically in force, I'm not sure about that, that we can use predators and Reaper drones, but no hot air balloons, right? And that's sort of an example of the danger of sort of seeing a technological development, responding to it with something that seems very, very forward-looking. And I think in retrospect, we all kind of chuckle when we hear the Balloon Warfare Convention as sort of one of these great intellectual misfires of international law. And there's a danger when you think about sort of comprehensive legislation in spaces that are moving very quickly technologically, moving very quickly conceptually in terms of what your objectives are. There's a danger to sort of writing rules that kind of lock things in and may really miss the point. So on the other hand, I think there's also, importantly, danger in the other direction. And the danger in the other direction is that you have you know, Congress absents itself from the field, or in other countries, whatever legislative processes exist are sort of bypassed. You end up with compromises, political compromises, legal compromises that lack certain democratic legitimacy, and that defy that kind of fifth grade civics logic that, right, you know, if you have a new situation, you have some desire to have, you know, answers to those questions that reflect the basic constitutional architecture of the countries in question. And in our case, in the case of the United States, that there is some very important, I understand this is different in parliamentary structures, but you know, for us, there is something very deep, very simple, and very powerful about the idea that when you have major policy to create rules about, you do that through the Congress of the United States, and that's a process that we, at some very deep level as a society, believe in. And so I think you can see in that basic dichotomy, the sort of dangers in both directions. And so with that as a preface, I want to take a look back. And we've now had 10 years of trying to legislate or trying to avoid legislation in the counterterrorism space. And take a look back and see sort of how we've done and how, you know, how good or ugly is it. Now, a few years ago, I wrote a book on this subject, and it concluded with a very dour kind of assessment of the situation. This was my book, Law and the Long War. And it ended just as the Boumediene decision, which was the decision that established habeas jurisdiction over Guantanamo, was about to come down. Everybody kind of knew where it was going. And just as I was finishing the book, I was finishing the book just before it came down, and I kind of wrote the postscript to the book with this, you know, idea that we had not answered the foundational questions of what to do with people when you capture them. Where do you, what can you, where do you hold them? What can you, what law do you hold them under? What are the interrogation rules? What do you do when you want to bring them to trial? That these questions, which were, you know, open in 2001, when the conflict started, still seemed to me to be very open. And I wrote, at the risk of the vanity that it seems whenever you quote yourself, as well as quoting yourself saying something that you're not immediately going to turn around and say you were wrong, here's what I wrote. What I said is, if American forces catch Ayman al-Zawahiri or Osama bin Laden the day after the decision, we will still have nothing remotely resembling, nothing approaching a consensus regarding what to do with them, where to do it, or what rights they should have. And I kind of went on in that vein for a while, that we'd sort of made no progress kind of writing the rules of the conflict that we want to fight. And when Commander Adams called me and asked me to give this talk, I mean, the first thing I said was, you know, actually, that's not quite true anymore. And in the last few years, I think you can actually say that, well, first of all, that Congress has been a great deal more active than it had been. And secondly, that some of those foundational questions that were troubling me 6-7 years after 9/11 that hadn't been answered have at some level now been answered. So let me give you a few examples of this. The first is, and this is an issue that bothered me a lot, that Congress had never put its name behind the project of non-criminal law of war detention in the counterterrorism space. And this seemed to me to be a very deeply offensive thing. There's a wonderful debate that has been going on in the United States for 10 years now about detention, and I've participated in it with a number of people in the audience. But it always seemed to me to be very offensive that if we were going to be, you leave aside the merits of the policy, that whatever the policy was, that Congress should not have its name behind the policy. That this should be done in a debate between Congress, between the executive branch on the one hand, the courts on the other hand, and lawyers and human rights activists on the third hand. That the Congress was just sort of absent from that debate. Well, that's not true anymore. So in last year, Congress passed the National Defense Authorization Act, which contained in it for the first time, and I think this is actually spiritually very important, affirmative authorization for the detention operations that the United States is engaged in. Not only that, but the NDAA contained an authorization for the review process for detainees at Guantanamo, which had previously been done either initially ad hoc or subsequently subject to a presidential executive order. All of a sudden, you're looking at a situation where Congress has authorized the conflict, authorized the detention operations, and authorized the review process. Now, that actually does seem to me, leave aside the merits, the legitimate debate of the merits of the policy, it seems to me a pretty profound change. Second example, when I wrote Law on the Long War, Congress had passed the 2006 Military Commissions Act. This was understood, rightly or wrongly, to be a Bush administration bill rammed through Congress on the eve of a midterm election. And it lacked a certain, certain bipartisan legitimacy in some sense, in addition to having a number of specific provisions that were very controversial. I think that has fundamentally changed. The debate over military commissions continues, but the Military Commissions Act of 2009, passed by a Democratic Congress with a Democratic administration, makes it very hard to argue that the institution of military commissions is the creature of one party, is the creature of one administration. All of a sudden we have a sort of answer to the question, how does Congress want a certain set of trials to take place? Third, and this is an example that's a little bit, I think for me personally, uncomfortable. I don't like what Congress has done here. But Congress stopped dead in its tracks the administration's plan to close Guantanamo. Now, that's merits are complicated. But not only did Congress stop the plan to close Guantanamo, Congress specifically stopped the transfer of individual detainees to countries that might want to take them. So you have a major administration policy going on that Congress says, forget about it. And actually, the administration turns around and respects that, which is, just an assertion of legislative muscle, a pretty different thing from what I was thinking about in 2008 when I was lamenting the sort of lack of congressional musculature in thinking about counterterrorism issues. And then finally, two other examples, one outside the military context is the FISA Amendments Act, where Congress writes a quite comprehensive scheme to govern what had previously been President Bush's, warrantless wiretapping program. You can look at it and you can agree with the policy, you can disagree with the policy, but it's pretty hard to look at it and say there isn't legislative architecture that's been developed. And then the final element, which I think is in some ways the most significant, though it hasn't passed, is that Congress in the NDAA seriously contemplated, talked about, debated, and the House actually passed legislation that would have reaffirmed the authorization to use the military force itself and somewhat alter the AUMF. Now this is, I say perhaps the most important because again, agree with it, disagree with it, like it, dislike it, it is the tectonic legislation of the conflict itself. And so all of a sudden you go from when I wrote that disparaging, despairing line about Congress not being involved, very short time ago, you have a kind of an impressive body of legislative activity, some of it resulting in legislation, law, some of it not, that has erupted across a range of areas that were previously contested and which Congress was previously absenting itself. And I think that body of law gives rise to a sort of lot of questions. You know, why did it develop, you know, 9, 10 years after the conflict started? What good is it? Is it valuable? What role is Congress playing? And I think it allows us to sort of step back and evaluate. You know, you can look at each individual piece of legislation individually and with a certain, you know, each one is a legitimate subject of a lot of debate. But I think there's two broad points I would make about it, about the spree. The first is that almost every issue, I mean, the single exception is interrogation, which, you know, has not been the subject since 2005 of significant legislation. With the exception of interrogation, which is not really in play right now because there's no real, there's no executive appetite to exceed the Army Field Manual, and so there's no, you know, the issue isn't really right in some respects. With the exception of interrogation, all of the issues that I was concerned had not been addressed have now, to one degree or another, been addressed. And I think that's a pretty striking thing. And as I say, that gives you an opportunity to kind of step back and look and say, what good is it? Is it any good? Does it do any? Has it had any value? What function is Congress playing? And so what I want to do here is talk about what I think the three major functions that Congress is playing. And then I will open it up for questions and comments and telling me why I'm wrong. I think, you know, Congress is not playing, let me start by saying, the role that this fifth grade civics class would have it play. That is to say, looking at the problem prospectively, seeing that the big problem in life is balloon warfare and writing a balloon warfare law, right? That would be the way the fifth grade class would say Congress should behave, except it should get the answer right, unlike the balloon warfare convention. I think the first role that Congress is playing is we might call, I'm gonna name three. I think the first is codification. And codification specifically of understandings and consensuses that develop elsewhere in government. So the NDAA detention authorities are really interesting examples of this. Where does this language come from? The NDAA enshrines in law the president's power to detain those who were part of or substantially supporting Al-Qaeda, Taliban, or associated forces. Now this language is almost verbatim language that first articulated in the March 13th brief in the Hamlili litigation. So it actually comes from the executive branch. It's adopted in slightly different form by the DC Circuit Court of Appeals. And then Congress comes back 2 years later and writes it into statute. So it's already law by the time Congress passes the NDAA. And Congress's function here is largely one of codification of an understanding already reached between the executive branch and the courts. Now you can say at one level, well, what good is that, right? I mean, it's sort of, you know, going onto the field of and shooting the wounded, right? I mean, the legislative and the executive and judicial branches have already thrashed out in a great deal of litigation what the substance of the rules are. And then Congress kind of comes along 2 years later and says, oh, by the way, here's the substance of the rules. And the same exact thing, by the way, happens with the review process. The president goes through this, from everything we hear, a sort of amazing interagency process to develop this executive order. Some of you guys probably were involved in it. There is an executive order promulgated. Congress comes along and writes a law that says, by the way, we want you to make the following tiny little changes in that executive order, and we're going to add a comma here, and other than that, that's the law, right? And that's basically what happened. I would argue that the codification function is actually very important. It's not very emotionally satisfying, but I think it is very important. It serves a hygienic function in a democracy. And the hygiene function is something like this. Somebody like me spent 5, 6, 7 years complaining, why won't Congress put its name behind what it's asking US forces to do? We go out there, you guys have to run, you know, people have to run detention facilities, And people complain over and over and over again, U.S. forces are engaged in activity nowhere mentioned in the authorization to use military force is the word detention. And that is a specious argument, in my opinion. But it's a consistent argument over a long period of time, and it matters whether Congress is willing to say those words that people keep pointing out that it hasn't said. So I think the codification function is a weird function. It's a function that does have this feel of a retroactive stamp that has very little practical consequence. I do think it is an important function in almost a spiritual sense. Second function is institutionalization. Now this is to some degree, the line between this and codification is a difficult one, and they overlap a lot. But two examples, the institutionalization function I think of as where Congress kind of steps in and authorizes activity, creates new institutions that didn't exist before. So think about the combination of the two Military Commissions Acts. Think about the FISA Amendments Acts. Now these are partly codifications in the sense that the Bush administration had created military commissions. It had created the wiretapping program, right? And Congress comes in and creates institutional structures. In both cases, there had been severe legitimacy problems. In one case, the Supreme Court had come in and stepped in, right, and shut down the commissions. And Congress comes in and basically gives institutional permission under the following set of circumstances for this activity to continue. This is not a policy idea that originates in the legislature in either case, not in the FISA Amendments Act case, where you have an existing set of activity that needs an institutional structure, it needs law to continue. And not in the Military Commissions Act case. But in both cases, you have Congress responding to the breakdown of support and legitimacy for the activity, stepping in and saying, okay, here are the situations in which this institution is legitimate. And the result is, in both cases now, you have, granted with dissenters, a fairly broad political consensus that allows those activities to continue. That's the second function. Then the third function, and I think we've now had direct examples of this in both directions, is what you might call a redirect function. And here you have an existing set of executive policies, and Congress basically steps in and says, No, you know, can't do that. So three examples of this. One is the Detainee Treatment Act, where, you know, Congress steps in and says, you know, this whole coercive interrogation thing, cut it out, right? Not going on in the U.S. military. And even in its own way has the effect of putting a stop to the CIA program as well, or greatly causing reform to it. More recently, we've seen the redirect function in the other direction. The Obama administration comes in with the desire to close Guantanamo, with the desire to transfer a lot of people. And Congress basically, after a few months of letting the president, you know, bask in his executive orders, puts a real brake on that, and really ties the administration knots over it. And if you read, I just finished reading Danny Clydman's book, Capture or Kill, Kill or Capture, which is, you know, I really recommend just as a portrait of this redirection on Congress's part and the degree to which the legislature was able to just change the administration's capacity to get this thing done. Now again, the lines between these different functions are sometimes hard to gauge. So the same act, the Detainee Treatment Act, for example, contains element of institutional creation. It created the direct review of CSRT hearings in the DC Circuit, for example. That was a real institutionalization of some kind of authority. It also stopped a lot of, you know, it completely redirected with respect to interrogation. Ditto the NDAA. It had elements of redirection with respect to Guantanamo. It had elements of institutionalization. It had elements of codification. So these functions are not necessarily all pointing in the same direction. They're not always congruent, and the same law can do more than one. But I think broadly speaking, those are the three roles that you can see Congress playing in legislating for that this last 10 years of conflict that we've passed. Now, what are the lessons of this? It's like three lessons and then stop. Look, it took a long time. That's the first lesson. Congress waited until, you know, just to put it in very personal terms, waited until after I'd written a book saying, why aren't they legislating? Why aren't they getting involved? Right? You know, they really spent a lot of time waiting, letting other actors take the lead before it got involved. And I think that's a very significant fact. This is, Congress is not going to be the lead actor in defining the rules. It's going to be a secondary or tertiary actor responding at long last to the iterative development of rules in other venues. Number two, when it does get involved, and this is a sort of sub point of number one, when it does get involved, it's going to largely be in the business of ratification and second guessing, not in the business of, in the first instance, kind of sketching out the parameters. And this brings me to the real point with which I want to leave you. That means that there will be long periods of uncertainty, inherently. That means that there will not be, the bomb goes off, the cyber attack happens, the, you know, whatever it is that's going to trigger the need for new rules, and you're going to see a spree of responsive legislative activity that actually defines the new rules. It means that other actors, sometimes for years and years and years at a time, are going to be taking the lead. And some of those other actors are, as a practical matter, you guys, who are left advising people in operational situations in which the body of law is simply inadequate to give coherent, certain answers. And I think, you know, I would love to tell you that there is, you know, a legislative path that will answer, that can give certainty, and I just don't think it's true anymore. I think what is true is that Congress eventually will get there, but you will have to get there first. They will not get there in time to answer the questions that you will need to address. And you have to be comfortable at some level being the front lines of, in the face of grave uncertainty as to where the law will ultimately rest. So with that cheerful but admiring conclusion, I will take whatever questions you have.
Thank you for listening to the Lawfare Podcast, a project of the Harvard Law School Brookings Project on Law and Security. Our music was performed by Sophia Yan.